Of all the nightmares, the worst are the ones that occur when you're awake. Summer 1999, a small Ontario city. Angela and Barry have taken a big step and moved in together. It's a modest basement apartment, and they have a dream of sharing a bright future. But as Barry heads for work, a stranger is about to turn their dream into a nightmare. Investigation and conviction may take years. But every detective knows that the crucial clue is always there, somewhere in the first 72 hours. Amount of water can wash away what happened. As Angela slept, a stranger crept into her bedroom and sexually attacked her. Now that Barry is here, she calls police. Angela recounts each detail for Detective Lori Ewing, beginning with the horrifying way she was awakened.
The victim was awakened early in the morning by a stranger in her room, and he sexually assaulted her and stayed for approximately 20 minutes. He threatened her with a knife to ensure some compliance on her part, and sexually assaulted her in a number of ways over that period of time.
Angela was utterly at his mercy. He threatened to cut out her eyes if she didn't do what he wanted. As he fondled her with hands sheathed by surgical gloves, the stranger whispered her name as if they were lovers. Then, before he left, he stole a photo of her. Forensic identification officers scour the apartment, but find no fingerprints, no hair, no fibers, not even a clue as to how the rapist got into Angela's locked apartment. In cases of sexual assault, the victim is the primary crime scene. Police take Angela to the hospital to be examined. The rapist may have left biological evidence on Angela's body, but police are worried that it may have been completely washed away when she showered. Clinical nurse specialist Ann Finnegan is understanding.
A great number of people shower before they come in and see us. I think it's that wanting to get clean. If we think of Lady Macbeth washing her hands repeatedly, trying to remove the stain, it may be an odor, it may be an olfactory sensation that they can smell the person on them. I think it's the most natural reaction in the world to want to shower.
To help the nurse find any possible biological evidence, Angela has to relive every detail of the nightmare.
The examination can be intrusive, that the areas that have been held, restrained, kicked, licked, touched, massaged, whatever, are going to be examined, and hopefully samples will be able to be isolated that will assist the police in their investigation. There was touching of an intimate nature. So someone can very much be sexually assaulted and there can never be actual intercourse that takes place or what we consider to be intercourse.
There was no semen sample, but the attacker did something strange. He licked Angela behind her ear.
It's a slim chance, but maybe some saliva remains even after the shower.
There's a body sample that's above the skin. We can identify that with the Woods lamp. It fluoresces organic material sitting above the skin.
Against all odds, a trace of the rapist's saliva remains. But will it be enough to create a DNA profile of her attacker? Angela's next ordeal is to meet with a composite sketch artist and try to remember every detail of the face she wants to forget.
I like to go in cold and develop a facial image from the victim's language. That's just that simple. I do not like to refresh the victim's memory about the crime because that takes away from the image of the face. Surprisingly, most victims can put aside their emotions long enough in order to be able to work at a task because they also see the need for it.
Though the attack was traumatic and Angela tried to look away, the rapist's face seared on her brain.
She described what she referred to as a dirty-looking Santa Claus.
In 18 minutes, Angela's nightmare has a face. Police post the sketch around the neighborhood, hoping to get a tip about the rapist's identity and warn the public.
I think as with any case where you have a sexual predator that's unknown, there is a heightened fear that this individual could be anybody, could be anywhere, and might attack someone else.
Meanwhile, a lab technician successfully coaxes a DNA profile from the small saliva sample. This will be invaluable for testing suspects. But DNA samples don't come with names attached.
We know nothing about this individual. We know what his DNA is, but finding the DNA to match what we have is very, very difficult. So we take what little evidence we have in looking for a needle in a haystack.
But the DNA profile does lead somewhere. Not to a suspect, but to a victim. A week before Angela was attacked, a young woman named Eleanor was stalked and assaulted in her apartment. The DNA sample left on Eleanor matches the sample from Angela's rapist. And Eleanor confirms that the composite resembles her attacker. Detective Ewing notices similarities between the women. Both have blonde hair, light eyes, and a slim build. What gives investigators added concern? The second attack was in a second city, a half-hour drive away. The predator is broadening his target area. And the police have no idea where or who his next victim will be. A sexual predator is on the loose. Two matching attacks in 1 week. Each attack in a different Ontario city. Now in a third city, a sleep-deprived mother of twins is about to wake up to a living nightmare. The rapist restrains the woman and threatens to harm her children. He does everything except have intercourse. A strand of hair found on the woman's bed turns out to have the same DNA profile as the samples from the two previous rapes. It's clear to police that they are now after a serial rapist. Three separate jurisdictions have been hit so far. A joint task force is formed. Detective Lori Ewing is joined by Detectives Vicky McDonald and Darren Sweezy from the two cities where the other rapes took place. A pattern is emerging. The three victims are all blonde and slim. The attacker called each by her own name. and each of the crime scenes is near a highway, allowing the rapist a fast getaway.
All of the buildings were three-story walk-ups. All of the victims lived in the ground floor of those buildings.
I believe that he was a voyeur. He spent a great deal of time stalking his victims, going back and learning their patterns, watching them. He knew a lot of them by name, so that suggests that he spent a lot of time doing his homework.
I guess the best way to describe him, and he's been described as so, is a predator. And basically, it was a selection process on his part.
To get a better idea of the type of predator they're hunting, police call in a behavioral profiler.
They tend to be underachievers in their life. They don't really succeed at a lot of what they do, and that's financially, socially, academically. So we figured that this person would have a less than a skilled job. I was struck by the age of the offender. He was described by the victims as being somewhere between 40 and 50 years old, which is somewhat older for an offender.
Not all sexual offenders break in. He did, which suggests he might have a record for break and enter and theft.
He's breaking in to steal sex, essentially, so we expect him to have stolen other things in his life.
His behavior is unique.
The main underlying motivator is their sexually deviant fantasies. He seemed to have it in his head that he was making love to somebody rather than sexually assaulting them.
Even when restraining them, he would whisper their names.
Overall, we concluded that he would be a long-term offender with an established history of sexual offending that had yet to be identified.
The profiler adds one chilling note. This type of offender has a high risk of continuing his sexual assaults until he's caught. And the task force is determined to stop him.
We are very fortunate that the media is giving us lots of help in terms of getting an awareness out to the public that this individual is out there and we're looking for tips. We have it on television, we have it in the newspapers, and we start to distribute that composite.
You would think with a male with a beard that would help quite a bit, but you will not believe how many people have a beard in the cities around, and I think we met every one of them.
1,700 persons of interest were interviewed, and DNA samples were taken from 900 men. Each one is eliminated. After 9 months, there is still no suspect. Then, one May night, Detective McDonald goes back to one of the crime scenes on her own time.
I would go there often just to try to think, where would this guy go? One time that I was there, I was going into another residence nearby, and on the same street, this car just drove by very slowly. And I looked, I thought, oh my God, he has a beard. He looked at me and I looked at him. He wouldn't have known I was a police officer, I don't think. But, well, as soon as he did that, I thought, creepy, you know? There's something not right with this guy. So then I got the plate and had another look at him and gave me a little bit of a smirk, and I thought, this is very strange. So I called it in.
The suspect's vehicle is registered in a city within a half-hour drive of all three rape scenes.
So that was nice, because obviously he's mobile and he lives between the areas that were involved at the time. His criminal record suggested person we were looking at, a criminal harassment, stalking type record, and we thought, this is it.
As the profiler suggested, he had been an underachiever in school and worked as a dishwasher at night.
We set up the appointment and very arrogant throughout the interview and thought, this is him.
Harold Brown is his name and he fits the behavioral profile. The police think they may just have their man. Brown's DNA is compared to the DNA taken from the three attacks. But for the investigators, it's a giant disappointment. There's no match. Harold Brown is not the serial rapist.
It's frustrating, but you keep going with it. Like, you still know your bad guy's out there to find.
the tips are no longer coming in. And time and lack of money necessitate officially disbanding the task force. But unofficially, the three lead investigators don't let go. They feel a responsibility to the victims. Detective Ewing knows Angela, the first victim, still can't escape the memories of her attacker. No matter what she does, he's still there, watching, waiting. He shattered her relationship with Barry, destroyed her confidence. Angela moves away.
You lose a whole sense of self, you lose a sense of safety. You don't want to live there anymore. You don't have that sense of you can go into that room and not have the feeling that he might be there or he might come back.
6 months after the task force closed down, in the same building where Angela had been raped, one basement apartment over, a nightmare closes in. It's been over 2 years since Angela was raped in this building. Now a peeping Tom is spying into another basement apartment. Surprised by the woman's boyfriend. A chase. A license plate. A call to 911. The alert dispatcher transfers the call to Detective Sweezy, who runs the plate. Up comes the peeping Tom's name, someone they've never come across before. Robert William Krasuski. He has a rap sheet dating back over 30 years. He's served time for a series of physical assaults on women, as well as break and enter and theft. Krasuski has had a steady job, working on his own as a night janitor at a high school. He was hired before the Board of Education did criminal background checks. Detective Sweezy reaches the suspect on his cell phone.
He asked me what it was about, as most normal people would, and that's when I went on to say that it was of a sensitive nature and I'd rather meet with you face to face.
The next morning, Detectives Sweezy, Ewing, and McDonald arrive for their interview. Police had made 1,700 prior appointments, but this one would be the most surprising.
As you can very well imagine, your mind starts to race. You're thinking, what's going on? I mean, like I said, we were there just for an interview and caught totally off guard, and you start thinking of all these scenarios.
A suicide note read that Krasuski could no longer face the world or those he loved. But the note is not a confession. Toolbox, investigators find what is called a rape kit and Angela's stolen photo. But the investigators who spent years tracking him down know they need absolute proof. A blood sample is taken from the dead man. His DNA matches the saliva sample taken from Angela just a few hours after she was assaulted. 56-year-old Robert William Krasuski had been doing B&Es and sexual assaults on and off for years. His unsupervised job allowed him to hop into his car and come and go without explaining anything to anyone. He stalked his victims first, learned their names, and then broke in, fantasizing that it was consensual sex. As to why he never attempted intercourse, it turns out Krasuski suffered from adult onset diabetes, which left him impotent.
Regardless of his medical condition, his impotence, the sexual dysfunction he experienced, he was still compelled to go out and sexually commit. He still wanted to do it. The impotence merely changed how he could do it.
I can't speak of anything but praise for our victims and how they've managed to work through this and come through this. You don't get over it. You learn to cope with what you're feeling and you learn to move on to a degree, but they're changed in one way or another. They're changed by this man.
Police had been cheated of a sense of closure on a case that had held them captive for years.
He didn't have to face court. He didn't have to face coworkers or the public and go on trial for what he did. I think he knew from that phone call that his world was coming crashing down, and this is the way out. This is the way he would handle it.
Robert William Krasuski had been a predator for more than 30 years. Though the women he attacked and the investigators would have to settle for the case's strange conclusion, there was good news. The rapist would never again break into a woman's home and force her to live her worst nightmare. The stories on 72 Hours are true. The detectives and forensic scientists are the ones who actually worked on the case. The names of the victims are fictitious. The names of the convicted are real.